Well, if I were just going to be talking to historians, I would say that what they need to do is to look at their history much more carefully than the previous generations have looked at it, write it with greater care, confront the problems in a way that historians, I think, up to now have not confronted them.
Does that mean that historians should become social activists?
Not necessarily. It does mean, though, that they must say that this nation has never lived up to its own promises of freedom, of equality, of respect for the individual, of dignity, and all the rest of it, and that we have been too preoccupied with keeping other people in their places and refusing to grant to them what we have insisted for ourselves.
Historian John Hope Franklin. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about Southern history and African-American culture in the 1990s. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part four in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1995. Support for this program comes from the Ford Foundation, with additional funding from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. John Hope Franklin is among the giants of 20th century scholarship, the author of numerous important works about the South and the role of African Americans in the history of the United States. For many years, he taught at the University of Chicago before coming to Duke University to teach both history and law. John Hope Franklin is here now to reflect on several of the topics set forth in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center. The South and Its Future inaugurated the center's American Issues Forum, an annual exploration of ideas of national consequence that figure in the work of John Hope Franklin. John Hope, you know it's always a pleasure to welcome you back to the National Humanities Center. How are you doing these days?
Very well, thank you.
You enjoying your retirement?
What retirement? I'm in my third retirement, and I'm busier than ever.
My goodness. I want to begin the conversation with you, John Hope. Reflect for me. Tell me a story about how you, with a group of historians, 35 years ago, you're taking a trip, and where were you going? What were you going to do?
We were going to a national meeting. It was, at that time, the Mississippi Valley Historical Association. It's been renamed the Organization of American Historians. And we were going to the annual meeting. Five of us in a car, and traveling at night, and talking to each other to try to keep each person awake. And we discussed everything from predestination to ordination and to original sin, as well as various other things.
Those are good Southern themes, aren't they?
Yes. But we talked a good deal about the South and what it was and what it meant to each of us, and what we thought the South was doing in the way of moving one way or the other, making progress or retrogressing. We talked about the whole question of race. We talked about the South as a particular place, not merely in history, but in time and in the lives of its inhabitants. And we got to Cincinnati even before we wanted to, because we hadn't exhausted the topic.
How did you think about the South in those days, John Hope, as a young historian, and then how do you think about it today? How has it changed over that span of time for you?
Well, there are many people who believe that the South has not changed. If it did, that would not be a desirable move. But regardless of what one thinks personally, if one looks at the South objectively, if one looks at then and now, one cannot resist the conclusion that the South has changed.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed economically. It's changed politically. It's changed socially. In virtually every area of life, the South has changed.
How do you take the measure of those changes, John Hope? What kinds of yardsticks do you apply?
Well, if you were talking about economics, you look at the way in which the South has become more industrialized and the way in which the industrialization itself has become more diversified. There are automobile assembly plants in the South now. I don't believe there were any 35 years ago. There are many of the so-called new industries, service industries and that sort of thing. The Research Triangle Park here in North Carolina is a case in point, but this is only one of a number of centers of the new technology, mm-hmm. new industrialization that we find in the South. It certainly did not exist in the years shortly after the Civil War.
What about politically? What about politically, John Hope Franklin? How do you figure out what's happened to the South in those intervening years that way?
Well,
very big question.
Yes, it's a big question, but it's an important question. If you look at one yardstick, namely the number of African-American public office holders, you would see a vast change. You'd have maybe just a handful in 1959, and today you would have surely it would number into the hundreds. Moving on to into the thousands mm-hmm.
does,
of
office holders,
if it ranges all the way from mayors
sure.
of cities to uh-huh. members, elected members of school boards. And
let me stop you. Do we equate numbers with progress, with quality of life?
We equate first numbers with change, and that's important. The first thing you have to have is change. Secondly, I think that if you were speaking of progress in terms of the greater representation of the populace in the political process, mm-hmm. in governing, and then you would have to conclude that that the increase in the number of African Americans holding public office is a sign of progress.
Mm-hmm.
If you were talking also about the kind of participation in the political process, the number of people participating, I think that you'd have to say that there's been some progress there, too. When I look at the rate, when I look at the percentage of eligible voters who participated in the last primary in Durham, North Carolina, it wouldn't look too good because the percentage was down something like 20-21%. But if once more, if you look though at the opportunities which Southerners have, all Southerners, the electorate itself has increased in numbers, and of course, that means that if they want to. Mm-hmm. They can't participate.
But don't you argue at the same time, John Hope, I'm thinking back about those remarks that you gave when we opened the American Issues Forum here at the Humanities Center. There was also a sort of note of pessimism or caution, let's put it that way, in your comments, that many of these changes that you have been talking about, economically, politically, are essentially illusions because we still have a measurable amount of hostility, overt racism in the American South. How about that?
Well, I don't think there is necessarily a contradiction there. There is resistance to change. That's so characteristic of the South. The South is reluctant to change. I spoke of that in my presidential address at the Southern Historical Association many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If it can resist change successfully, it will do so. That doesn't mean that it isn't changing. whether you like it or not, whether Southerners are pleased with it, it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply changing. The resistance is even stepped up as it changes more dramatically.
And it comes from unexpected quarters, doesn't it? Or
it frequently does.
It becomes intensified in those quarters in any event.
Yes, some of the most respectable elements in the South
mm-hmm.
Resist change. For there is a whole panoply of Southern life that is supported by the status quo, you see. And if you change in one direction, there is fear that there will be other significant changes
sure.
which will undercut the very wonderful kind of Southern existence that we always associate with the South.
You make reference in this presentation that you gave at the National Humanities Center, John Hope Franklin, to a section here in Durham, North Carolina, called Haiti. That is to say, the black middle class, the development of a black middle class. I want you to comment on this for me, John Hope. Are you confident that American society is moving in the right direction when we speak of the development of a black middle class? Is that the ticket to success when we talk of change and progress in our race relations?
That's the ticket to success on the part of those who have the ticket.
Yeah.
And, of course, in Durham, North Carolina, which E. Frankel Frazier referred to as the capital of the black middle class, There were many signs of affluence and of economic growth and strength and whatnot. Large insurance company, large bank with many branches.
That would be Farmers and Mechanics and the North Carolina Mutual.
Yes, and the Mutual Savings Bank, mm-hmm. and a fairly considerable number of less well-known economic enterprises. For example, I didn't know until I had to find out that the only garage door company in Durham is African American.
Uh-huh.
If you can't get your door to work automatically, you have to call Ace Door.
Sure. Let me stop you for a moment. Now, those are local. Those are local phenomena. Do they have any implications when we again take the measure of change in the South, in the region, and in fact nationally? Again, when we speak of race relations.
Well, it's very interesting. While they are local, if you go from place to place in the South, you'll find other local types of enterprises,
uh-huh.
Which of course all put together would mean that you do have something of a phenomenon that is section-wide and perhaps even nationwide. I lived in Chicago for many years, and of course you've got a large black middle class there, large black economic enterprises that range all the way from mm-hmm. Ebony and Jet to Independence Bank and Southway Bank and others. And I think that you can say that you've got a very interesting development that is reflected in the growth of the black middle class. But that does not mean that blacks generally
mm-hmm.
are moving in that direction.
Let me, John.
As a matter of fact, as if I may say so, as blacks move toward what one might call the American middle class standards and values and whatnot, it leaves behind a vast number of what William Julius Wilson calls the underclass.
Right.
And the truly
disadvantaged.
The truly disadvantaged, and that number is increasing. So you've got an interesting phenomenon of growth of the middle class on the one hand and the growth of the underclass on the other.
Let me take you back to the political dimensions of our topic, that is to say change in the South and what those implications are for the national picture when we speak of race and American society. You have made reference, John Hope Franklin, to redistricting efforts. Now, let me take the other side of the argument. This is affirmative action. This is cosmetic. This is it is essentially not necessarily a good thing to do. That is to count by race rather than genuine political participation. Make the case for me for the redistricting efforts that have gone on here in North Carolina and that are going on all over the country to get black people into the process.
Well, if it was significant and important, as it was for more than a century, to count them in a certain way, to keep them out of the political process, it would seem that it might be desirable to count them, to get them into the political process. They were driven out by intimidation, mm-hmm. by violence, by legislation, and by various other moves and acts on the part of the state and the part of the nation. And as a result, they were deprived of their equal opportunities under the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment for years and years and years. So what's wrong with taking the same tact and trying to make our society more inclusive? If, for example, whites have deliberately drawn up districts to dilute the black vote, as they have done in the period from, say, the Reconstruction period down to now, what's wrong with trying to reverse that and to make a better case for American democracy by providing, by legislation if necessary, political opportunities for all Americans?
Don't you say, John Hope Franklin, that the word gerrymander goes back to the 19th century and it didn't necessarily have anything to do with race in those days?
No, it had to do with the drawing up of districts so that they would be beneficial to the people who drew them up. And the districts looked like salamanders in 1810, and that's why it was called gerrymandering, because Elbridge Gerry, who was a member of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and who had a lot to do with shaping our early political history, had something to do with shaping those districts, which were named for him.
John Hope Franklin, you have made reference again in this presentation that you did at the National Humanities Center for our American Issues Forum to what you call the prodigal Southerner, black people who left the South. Oh, my goodness. I mean, we could talk the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. They went away, and now they're back. Why did they leave, and what are they finding as they return?
First, let me say that that Southerners were prodigals, not merely because they were black, but because they were Southerners. That is, they were white prodigals as well. I've written a book about the prodigals of the 19th century. It's called Southern Odyssey. And there I'm talking about white people, because they were the only ones that were really free to move before the Civil War, and they moved, they went north in large numbers. There are large numbers of Southerners, even at the present time, who live in the North, who made their careers in the North. I frequently say to my friend Van Woodward, I said, you know, when are you coming home? He's been living in Connecticut so long. And there are large numbers of others. But, of course, If blacks were dragged to this country, as they were indeed in the 17th and 18th centuries, they voluntarily moved out of their dwelling places in the 20th century and went north. They went north for any number of reasons. It was the oppressive nature of the political process, for example, that might have driven some of them north. Surely it was for educational opportunities for their children, where in the segregated schools of the South that were seriously, seriously inferior. Now, they didn't find utopia in the North. They found discrimination. They found de facto segregation. And they found poor, inadequate housing. They found the ghetto, out of which they could not move, certainly not easily.
Is this why they're coming? Is this why black people are coming back to the South in the, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, over the past couple of generations?
Well, I think that they've come to believe that there's not nearly as much difference between the North and the South as they thought, and there is not nearly as much difference between the North and the South, maybe, as there once was. If certainly we have become more nationalized in our racial thinking and even in our discriminatory practices and so forth. And as the prodigal black Southerners look back from the North to the South, they have come to feel that maybe the South wasn't all that bad, or certainly is not that bad now. As they had once believed, it looks pretty good. Not merely the weather looks pretty good, but we're fighting the battles in the South. It's resulted in the elimination of some practices of segregation, the opportunities, the economic opportunities, have increased, and at least the grass looks pretty green when you view it from New York City or Brooklyn or Boston.
John Hope, I hear a certain note of optimism here when you talk of change in the South, and in fact the implications of that change for our national political picture, race relations, and yet you say that it is not yet time to celebrate.
No, not by any means.
And why is that?
Well, I certainly don't want to describe in terms of euphoria what has happened in the South up to now. When I speak of the differences between the South of, say, the 1940s and 50s and the South of the 1990s, I don't want you to get the impression that the changes that have taken place have been sufficient or they have been enough for us to celebrate. Not by any means. What we have, as I said earlier, is a persistent resistance to change that is all too frequently successful.
Do we call this racism? Let me just ask you to address that harsh word.
I'm not interested in categorizing it so much as I am in describing it and letting you reach the conclusion as you wish. Racism itself is so subjective that one must be careful about using it to describe any kind of development, because I'm not sure there's enough objectivity in the term itself. What you have, it seems to me, in the South, in this resistance, is an attachment to the past. It is a desire to remain settled. It is the sense of insecurity that change brings, and if it's with respect to race, whites simply, many whites don't want to change. I'm not saying that that's racism. I don't care what you call it. It's resistance to change. And if you're comfortable with racism, I'm not terribly comfortable with it, because it just simply is a kind of explosive term, which I don't think gets us anywhere. But if you want to use it, all right. I use resistance. I use opposition. I use even the creativity of seeking to maintain the status quo as an ample description of what we are about. Now, if you look at what's going on in the South, while it is not by any means satisfactory yet, the creation of, say, magnet schools, the merging of county and city schools, the development of the comprehensive school, both at the secondary and the middle school level, these developments first improve education generally in the South, and at the same time open up opportunities for both blacks and whites, because the magnet schools and the comprehensive schools are to attract children, not blacks, not whites, but students, you see. And in that sense, I think that's rather positive.
John Hope Franklin, what kind of advice would you give to the next generation of American historians? I'll ask you to address your particular corner of the universe. You look at these people from a vantage point of vast experience. How about it?
Well, if I were just going to be talking to historians, I would say that what they need to do is to look at their history much more carefully than the previous generations have looked at it. Write it with greater care. Confront the problems in a way that historians, I think, up to now have not confronted them.
Does that mean that historians should become social activists?
Not necessarily. It does mean, though, that they must say that this nation has never lived up to its own promises of freedom, of equality, of respect for the individual, of dignity, and all the rest of it. And that we have been too preoccupied with keeping other people in their places and refusing to grant to them what we have insisted for ourselves.
John Hope Franklin is Professor Emeritus of History and Law at Duke University, the recipient of more than 90 honorary degrees as well as dozens of other awards and honors. John Hope Franklin is the author of many books, among them From Slavery to Freedom, Race and History, and a biography of George Washington Williams. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian John Hope Franklin of Duke University. Audio tapes are available post-paid for $10. Our address is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 752. That's number 752. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week, the first in a series of programs for Women's History Month. Join me for discussions featuring the editors of the Oxford Companion to Women's Writing in the United States, the author of a new book about women and Italian-American identity, the editor of a new collection of writing by and about women of color, and the author of The Good Negress, a highly acclaimed new novel. Support for this program came from the Ford Foundation, with additional funding from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.